Coming up, Megan and I take a look at just a few of our favorite interviews from the year. It's the best interviews of 2017.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 12, recorded Thursday, December 14th. For Thursday, December 28th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by GoToWebinar, a trusted webinar platform with over 55,000 customers who have hosted over 2.7 million interactive web events to connect with their audiences. For more, visit gotowebinar.com/podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Tech News Weekly's Holiday Spectacular.
Woo!
This is the show where normally every week we talk about people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. We're still kind of talking with people making and breaking the tech news. It's just they broke and they moked them earlier this year.
Moked.
Is that the past tense of make?
Made.
I know. Okay. It's fun to say moped.
So we have a lot of people who have made the tech news. We've interviewed a lot of people, whether it be on Tech News Weekly or our previous show, Tech News Today. And this year it's been a doozy.
Yeah, it has.
It has been a doozy. I guess we say that every year. But not surprisingly, this year the most interesting interviews often surrounded the bizarre revelations about social media and its power over the personal and the political. We were already, if you can believe this, talking about this in January with our semi-regular in the third chair, Becky Worley. Let's take a look.
So, social media. Oh, yeah. It's taken on a new role of importance in our technological lives. I would think we would all agree. These platforms allow people, you know, they're very powerful. They allow people to participate in worldwide discussions, obviously on some of the highly charged emotional topics that we're talking about all the time in this day and age. Becky, you made a comment in show prep today that really stuck with me. I hadn't really thought of it. You said that this moment in time could be one of the most defining periods for social networks since their inception. Explain a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, about 2 hours ago, I was just thinking about this topic and I posted a little poll on Twitter. And I said, have you unfriended, muted, or unfollowed people for their political views or posts? And I've posted a bunch of different polls there. This one got a lot of attention. 300 people voted, and two-thirds have unfriended or muted people. Most of them saying that it wasn't that they didn't like their political views, that they want to hear other things and other opinions and not just have an echo chamber of their own opinions coming back at them. But it's the vitriol and that it made them feel yucky. And that one friend said it was either that or divorce my conservative parents. So, you know, I think a lot of people have stopped using Facebook. And just to show you how Facebook is a little bit concerned about this, I posted this 2 hours ago. I already got an email from Facebook PR asking me what my angle was.
Facebook PR is watching you closely.
So, you know, I also was thinking about, I'm doing a talk for parents about kids and why they use computers. And it got me thinking about all the things that we get from technology. And we've talked a lot about how certain things, when people like our posts, when we know people are paying attention or they make comments, that it gives us a dopamine hit, that it hits those pleasure centers of the brain. Well, guess what? The opposite is true as well. I mean, I've had some interactions on Facebook where I walked away and I was having a physical emotional reaction to something that had happened. So just as it can be a pleasure center, it can also be an incredibly negative experience. I think I have not seen a dog on a skateboard for months.
Yeah. They don't skate anymore. They stop skating.
You know, the amount of kid pictures has really dried up. And I think, to go back to your original question of why do I think this is such a seminal moment, I think people feel strange posting mundane things right now because it is not a mundane time. And therefore, right. social media has become very politically charged, and we're not getting warm fuzzies out of it. Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking about it. What can we do? What are the, and I really want your opinion. So tweet me at B Worley on Twitter if you have some ideas, or I have a public Facebook page, The Becky Worley. Here's my thinking right now. And please, you guys, chime in as I go through this. I'll stop after each one. So the first one is, don't post something political if you can't handle the comments. If you're posting something to convince someone else of your point, you have to be open to similar conversion. It may not be a total overhaul of your ideals, but if a friend reads your post, they've opened their mind. And if they want clarification or to disagree, they're going to comment, and you owe it to them to read that comment with an equally open mind.
I think that is a really good point, and I agree with that. I mean, I was talking to somebody about just people that disagree with some of the things I've said on Twitter. And, you know, that person said, oh, do you hate having, like, people be involved in what you're saying like that? And I said, no, I love it. Like, I do not want to be in this West Coast bubble. Like, that is not where I want to live. And I want to hear other people's opinions. I welcome them. And I really like that kind of discussion. And I mean, you brought up kids earlier, and I think that is, I'd like to talk a little bit more about that too, because I think that kids are on social media too. I mean, maybe not yours, because I know they're not allowed to use computers, Becky, which I applaud. But mine, however, are on social media, and it's rough out there for them, because, and they're just, a lot of kids are not ready for that kind of feedback that they get in expressing their opinions. I'll use the example of, you know, lots and lots of kids were posting pictures of themselves at various marches, various women's marches. And I know I've talked to a lot of girls, my daughter's friends and people, my friends' daughters, who said that they were getting a lot, these girls were getting a lot of negative feedback from boys about their pictures, saying, like, why are you marching? What's that? That's dumb and that's stupid. And to me, it was their feedback was very similar to how, like, girls and boys just pinch each other. Like, they're young, and they're trying to figure out who they are and what they believe. And they really, doing it on Snapchat or on Instagram in comments is really difficult, and it can be really misunderstood. So a mom might see, like, that a boy said, like, you know, why did you march? I don't get it. That's stupid. They might see that as cyberbullying, but what I see it is that just kids trying to figure out just the way that, as if they were on a playground. And I think that I do think that we need to prepare our kids for that kind of feedback and how to deal with it and what it means and what it doesn't mean.
Yeah, there are a lot of, it feels like a blunt stick sometimes. Those comments can really, and I can only imagine with kids, because they just, it's just so harsh to them in that moment. So, I mean, that's a tough one with kids, man. All right, I'm going to go back to my treatise here. If you make a comment about something posted, make sure you actually read the thing that was posted, or you watch it all the way through. Amazing how much commentary back and forth goes to the person not actually reading the thing. This is an interesting one I want your take on. If you comment on someone's post and one of their friends replies and tries to get into a flame war with you, ignore it. A friend of your friend on Facebook is not your friend. You know, like all of a sudden somebody came back at me about something that I posted, and I was like, oh, that makes me feel terrible about Tina. And then I realized Tina didn't say that. Right. It was Tina's friend.
If that person wasn't connected to Tina, it would really just end up being another random person on the internet, which, you know, I mean, and you get a lot of that on Twitter, right? Like, the different platforms have different strengths and weaknesses. On Twitter, you put something out, pretty much anyone is likely to find it at some point or another, and you might hear random comments to that thing that you said, good or bad, and you have no idea who that person is. So maybe that makes it easier for you to just, like, brush it off and move along with life. But on Facebook, there's just, like, this... At least for me, with my Facebook account, which I should add, I think I said this last week, I have not visited since, I think, the 1st of December. I kind of stepped away from Facebook. I don't know if or when I'm going back at this point, but I'm not on there right now. But at that point, mine was more of a personal Facebook account. It wasn't opened up to everyone. It wasn't like a public, you know, I'm on Twitter. Hey, everybody follow me. I kept it personal because I wanted to kind of keep it close, keep it family, friends, and some acquaintances and whatever. And because that was the design of my Facebook, my intention, any sort of criticism that would come through on that, didn't see a whole lot of it. But if it happened, it made it that much more personal. Even if it was a person that I didn't know, it was connected to somebody else, it still felt like there was some extra layer of validity to it because of my intention of the Facebook post and it being through a connection of somebody else. It still kind of felt like it was personal. You know?
The more raw it gets, the more I actually want to be on Twitter because I don't take it personally. I feel like, yeah, there's right. people that I don't know that well. So if they disagree with me, of course, but my friends, it hurts.
Yeah.
I think one thing that I Denise Howell from This Week in Law has won Facebook for me this year because it was the best post I've ever seen. It was, I hope you guys have enjoyed all the comments I've written and then deleted.
Oh, been there, done that. I know that feel. Yeah.
Okay. Here's another one. Use the tools Facebook provides for offensive or just messed up content. You can report fake news or misleading headlines. You can report truly offensive comments. And here's the thing. The other person never sees that you've reported the content. But you know who does? The algorithm. So it pushes that lower in everyone's Facebook feed so fewer people see it. Really, and I personally am just saying to you now, thank you for that. Please do more. I don't think we use those tools because we're afraid we're going to tick people off.
I think you're absolutely right. And because again, all services are different. Some services, as a user, it can be very confusing to know what is a signal just to the service? What is just a tool for me? Or what is a signal to the person that you don't intend for them to know that you've done anything? And then suddenly you've made a bigger comment than just replying something, replying to them saying, I disagree with you. You've given them the hand and the face, essentially,
right.
And that has the potential to create a bigger issue out of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And they'll never see it.
I mean, how do these services make sure that users understand this? Because I think that's actually a really important one, right? Like, they want to make sure that the users on the service are happy and are going to keep coming back and have the tools to be supported and everything. Because if those users walk away, then they aren't getting that, you know, they aren't getting those signals, they aren't getting those ad impressions, all that kind of stuff. But I think you're right. I would agree that probably people don't do it and they just kind of suffer in silence in that regard because they're afraid, because they don't fully understand what that tool actually does. And you know, that's
Facebook
a challenge for the service.
Yeah, Facebook has put up, you know how sometimes you log on and there's like a little public service announcement that's kind of at the top of your feed, like you can keep track of who sees what content and limit some people from seeing certain things. Well, they also have done ones where they say you can flag offensive content. I think now would be in their best interest to do more of that, promoting the tools and letting people know the anonymity of that type of reporting. Okay, my last one, I'm a football fanatic. And so I have used filters at times to try and block all the scores of the football games. Mm-hmm. They kind of work, but not 100% of the time. But if you're filtering out politics, there's a politics filter for Facebook that you can download for Chrome. There's a Trump filter for Chrome for the entire web. Block stuff. See how it goes for you. Maybe that works for you for a little while. Doesn't have to be forever, but maybe while things are feeling very raw. I start reading again. I've picked up this thing. It has all this paper in it and the ink. Yes, it was amazing.
When you're done with a page, do you push a button and all the words change to new words?
You know, Megan, you accuse me of being like crazy Waldorf mom, but I actually will only buy books so my kids see me reading and not reading.
That's smart, actually. Yes.
You hide your iPhone in there?
Yeah. It's a cutout on the inside with your phone.
No, right?
Why are you tapping your book?
I'm definitely using Instagram more. That's for sure. That's one thing. And then the other thing I would say is don't click through links to political stories in Facebook. If something interests you, pick the media outlet of your choice that you trust. I'm going to say that again, the media outlet that you trust,
whatever.
And
it may
go
be.
Search it. Go through the front door of that media outlet and search the headline or the story and read it in the place where you trust the news. Not just for fake news, but because I think it really, in this time of uncertainty, helps to have a couple of media outlets whose certainty and voice you can hold as a static place and to go back there for consistency. You know, the Pew report says that the Wall Street Journal has the most trust across all five of the political categories that they make, from extremely liberal, moderate, all the way to extremely conservative, that the Wall Street Journal is the only one that all five categories have trust in. The BBC, USA Today, ABC News, and strangely enough, Google News also have four out of five categories of people who trust them. I would take Google News out of there because I think they have some real AdSense problems and they're working on it. I would take USA Today out because I don't like the depth. I think their stories could have more depth.
Yeah, I would agree.
But, you know, personally, I'm obviously going to advocate for my employer, ABC. I trust the process and I've seen how the sausage is made. And I read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I leave it to you to find the media organizations you trust. But go through the front door of the sites you trust and search there.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to the point you were making about nobody posting any fun pictures anymore. No more dogs skateboarding. I was reading a piece over the weekend on Medium about just sort of how to manage this political time. And there was some really good advice in it. Basically, if you're outraged by what's going on right now, stay outraged. But that doesn't mean that you have to be enraged constantly. Like you, and that if you're just scrolling through Twitter all the time or maybe Facebook, you're going to just stay unhappy. And that's not good for anyone. And that's not going to do any good. Like, that's not going to help you fight against what you might be trying to fight against or support. What you might be trying to support, then log off, like read the book. You don't have to feel guilty about not constantly knowing what the news is. And if you keep staying on Twitter or just keep reading these stories that are going to upset you, then you're not going to be able to remain outraged. They're going to just become normal. And so I think that I just think it's okay to log off, to not feel guilty about that, and to know that do what you can, support what you can, fight against what you can, but you don't have to do that by constantly being, you know, having an IV of Twitter or Facebook going constantly.
That is such an amazing point, because after, you know, having participated in the march, not in DC as you did, but I walked away feeling so fired up and not knowing exactly how to channel that. And I think, you know, that advice to just pick the things that are important to you, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, pick the one or two things that are important to you and go work on it. That's all you can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you're going to keep working on this. We're going to check out Bea Werley to stay updated on your advice on politics.
Well, yeah, or you give me your advice. Trust me, I'm working it out as we go here, too.
Earlier this summer, you may remember that Tesla surprised many people, it was a surprise to me anyways, when they unveiled the now eagerly anticipated Model 3. YouTuber Marques Brownlee, an all-around awesome guy, was at the event and shared his thoughts from his time spent with the supercar. Elon Musk, when we talked about this a little bit last week, held his big Tesla Model 3 event last Friday, showing off the sought-after sedan as it was delivered to the first crop of lucky owners. Marques Brownlee, you may know him as MKBHD, was there at the event and left with some serious bragging rights, which we'll talk about. He's here today to tell us about his experience. Welcome, Marques.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back. So first of all, you've been to a million and maybe a million and one consumer tech events at this point. So I have to imagine this was a nice change of pace. Does Tesla put on a good show in this case?
Yeah, they do. So this was interesting because it wasn't really a consumer-facing event. It was actually for employees. So the majority of the people there worked for Tesla already, and it was kind of Elon talking to them. But it was broadcast to the world, and it was still really entertaining.
Yeah, everybody got a window in. And I mean, you wouldn't have known that it wasn't a consumer-facing event because everybody online was really anticipating finding out a little bit more about the Model 3, which they did. Which, by the way, you got the chance to actually drive one. Was it that morning? And tell us a little bit about your experience.
Yeah, it was. So it was like in the middle of that day, way before that nighttime event. I was in, I can't say his last name, but I'll say Franz, the lead designer over at Tesla, was my co-pilot. It was his car that we drove and did about a 15-minute loop around Fremont, around the factory, as we talked through the car and he explained what was different about it from the Model S, et cetera, which is kind of naturally what I compare most cars to anyway. And it was great. So it was pretty similar in responsiveness to the Model S. You kind of stomp on the pedal and you get an immediate response just because that's how electric cars are. But then obviously the interior of the car is super blank, super clean, super minimal. So if you're into that, that's great. But obviously it takes some getting used to because everything is on that screen, from the radio controls to AC to the mirrors and controlling where the AC goes. So it's really interesting, but it feels futuristic and it feels really similar to my current Tesla. So I was into it.
So was this one of the base $35,000 models or did it have a lot of upgrades, the one you drove?
I'm guessing the car I drove cost about $50,000 because it was the long range model. So it had the slightly beefier motors, 0-60 and 5.1. And it had the premium interior package, which meant it has a glass roof and the wood trim and the higher end speaker system. So that right there puts it at $54,000 and it had autopilot. So it was pretty well equipped. They didn't really have any base cars to drive.
Now, you mentioned the interior layout, and when I was looking at it and, you know, kind of prepping for having you on today, I thought about what I feel like I know about you, Marquez, is that you do like kind of minimal as it intersects with technology. I mean, when you take a look at the interior of this vehicle, like saying minimal is kind of an understatement because it's like the dash. Yeah. It's just like a long, slender dash. And in the center panel is a big screen.
That's it.
I mean, is that appealing to you? And do you think people are going to get used to kind of like that center position screen as opposed to having the readouts in front of the driver's seat?
Yeah, so obviously every car has an instrument cluster right behind the steering wheel. So yeah. It was a little weird looking off to the side to see the blinker and the speedometer and all that. The explanation I got is obviously they intend for these cars to be autonomous in the near future. So hopefully it won't be as weird to sit in the driver's seat and not really have to look down too much. So, you know, the bare interior, not a whole lot of buttons, was obviously appealing to the minimalist in me. But yeah, you see the interior. It still does definitely have a little bit of a learning curve to look over there for literally all the functions of the car. But, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like I could see myself getting used to it. I only have two screens in my car now. If you subtract one, kind of just means you look to the same place every time.
Yeah.
So I know before we started the show, you hadn't put your video up yet for your review. So I always wonder, how is it different to review this Model 3 Tesla versus like an iPhone?
Oh, no, it's up now.
Yeah.
Oh, it's up?
Yeah, 14 minutes ago.
I just dropped the video a couple minutes ago. That's right. it definitely is different, mostly because, I guess, first of all, at this event, it was interesting because when we did those test drives, it was no photos or videos allowed during the day. So obviously all the journalists who are writing their articles had a field day and they wrote everything they needed to. I, on the other hand, came back to the studio and was talking through my experience with the car, so that was a little different. But I am doing more car stuff now, which is a lot more fun, but also a lot more work because you're shooting different angles. It requires a team.
Yeah.
Shooting a phone doesn't require a team. It requires someone to drive a car, someone to shoot the video of the car while driving. So it's more work, but it also is a lot of fun.
Yeah, right. I can imagine that. What about the Model 3 took you by surprise, if anything? What's something that really stood out to you?
Not a lot, mostly because I've followed it a lot. I think the one weird quirk was the AC, the way it works. So I've talked to this point a little bit, but you know how in most cars you have the AC and you have the little vents on, you know, a vent here, a vent there, and you kind of adjust the flaps where you want the air to point? Mm-hmm. This car just has one big slot all the way across the center and no flaps to point, but if you go in the touchscreen, you can sort of adjust where the airflow goes, up or at you or to the outside, which was just really interesting. I guess, and then there's also no glove box button. That's a button on the touchscreen also. So little things like that. Like, it's clearly super, super clean and sleek and minimal, but it still has a learning curve because of that.
Yeah, you better hope nothing ever happens to that touchscreen. Otherwise,
yeah,
you're hosed. Well, and I mean, another and along that same line, the smartphone in this case is your key.
Yeah.
So it's your key to get in and it's your key to start the car and drive away or whatever. Do you feel like everybody's ready for that kind of a shift? Feel like That's a big jump.
I don't think everyone's ready right now, but this is a super forward face. A lot of things about this car are like ready for 2019 or 2020. So the autonomy, that's number one. Having a smartphone, or the other option is this sort of credit card sized card, which has RFID and you walk up to the car and it unlocks. So it has the same functionality as like a, I guess, a normal key fob.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole smartphone controlling your car thing is new to most people.
So you already have a Tesla, and this is, of course, the least expensive model. Is it something you would I don't know if you would upgrade to. I don't know if you'd say upgrade, but is it something, is the Model 3 something that you would consider yourself, would consider driving?
Because I own a Model S, no, I'm not getting a Model 3. I do know a lot of people who were considering a Model S, never pulled the trigger because it was a little out of price range or they didn't have that option, and now the Model 3 is an option, they are getting it. So I'm not someone who's buying it, but I know a couple of people who are on board.
Yeah. Now, you not only got to drive one, as you have told us about, you walked away from the event a winner. You didn't win a car. But tell us tell us how you came to create the winning commercial and the Project Love Day ad contest, and what did you win?
Yeah, that was a fun one. So I haven't done a whole lot of car videos, but when I got my Tesla, it kind of acts like a piece of tech, so I decided to start making videos about it. And then, of course, you know, up comes this contest that Tesla's holding where anyone can just make a 90-second or less sort of fan-made ad. I was like, okay, obviously I'm going to just go ahead and try to make one with my car. And there were a lot of really conceptual, really dreamy, really interesting videos made about the whole idea of sustainable future and electric cars in general, which are really cool. One of my favorite entries was one about like spaceships for Earth. So a lot of fun stuff. I was kind of game planning mine, and then we ran up against a deadline, and we ran out of time to make it. So we were going to basically cancel the whole project. And then a couple of hours after we decided to cancel it, Tesla extended the deadline by another couple weeks. So we were like, all right, we have to make one. We went out, made this video, and it took us about 3 days to get everything shot and edited, just because a lot of what you're looking at is like on actual roads, and we had to plan all this stuff. But I think it turned out really well, and it was kind of a thrill to see it played on the big screen in front of all those employees, and I think everyone liked it, so it was really entertaining.
I think you have to work on your mean guy look a little bit, like when you're that yeah. One moment. Like,
I didn't have the mean mug going. I guess I should have, but yeah, that was a fun moment.
It's so great. It also could be a FedEx ad. It could be a Cheerios ad. I think you've got it all there.
Yep.
You were an equal opportunity ad creator.
Sure.
That is such a thing. Well, this is really awesome stuff. We really appreciate you coming on, and congratulations on the win. By the way, did you win anything, or is it just bragging rights?
Mostly that. I think I unofficially got an invite to the next Tesla event, which is the semi-truck unveiling, which is pretty cool. So I'll go to that. But mainly just favoriting the tweet from Elon was what I got out of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's pretty awesome, man. Thanks for coming on, and congratulations again, Marquez Brownlee. Where do you want people to go to find your review and all of your work?
You can check out the video I just dropped on everything I know about the Model 3. So youtube.com/, there it is at the top, MKBHD, or really any social /MKBHD. That's what's up.
Right on. Thanks again, Marquez. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, guys.
All right, have a good night.
I love Marquez. I would like to have him on all the time if we could.
Yes, every single episode.
he's unfortunately busy, but he's always so kind when he responds to us, isn't he?
He absolutely is. Yeah, Marquez is awesome. Up next, our discussion on that odd vending machine in Russia. Do you remember this one? It generates all those likes for dollars. We'll play that interview in a second. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by GoToWebinar, the sponsor for this show, the webinar platform that's hosted 2.7 million interactive web events with over 60 million views per year. Wow, that's a lot of views. GoToWebinar believes webinars are one of the best ways to interact with your prospects and customers instead of business presentations or company websites. With GoToWebinar, you can create custom email invitations, confirmations, and reminders, or you can even let GoToWebinar handle it with their automated email templates. You can display your company logo or custom image or both on all webinar materials, so it's branded to you. You can create and schedule pre-recorded webinars that are as interactive as live events, so people who are on the other end watching can get involved with either. Mobile friendly as well. You can schedule a webinar, you can edit a session, or track performance from your iOS or Android device directly. You can also create up to 20 polls before the session, or even on the fly if you happen to have the bandwidth to do that for audience interaction. You can add up to 20 questions to a survey and then engage participants with Q&A, and that makes it a whole lot more dynamic. Engage your audience with more than one presenter and panelist. Up to 6 presenters can share their webcams and participate face-to-face. You can broadcast a view of your desktop or a specific application, and with GoToWebinar's reporting and analytics, you're just a click away from qualified leads, metrics, and data to improve webinars. You'll have end-to-end 128-bit AES encryption. It's actually rated number one in customer satisfaction. So turn your next presentation into a conversation with GoToWebinar. For more information, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. That's GoToWebinar.com/podcast. And we thank GoToWebinar for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Next is an interview from one of my favorite guests, and it also definitely features one of my favorite titles that the chat room came up with this year, From Russia with Likes.
That was a good one.
Back earlier this year, remember we thought Russia's influence on Facebook was still just funny.
So funny.
Louise Mistakis from Motherboard told us about one unlikely place where people can purchase likes. The idea of buying likes or followers isn't new, but Louise Mitsakis from Motherboard recently came upon a photo of a vending machine in a mall that will sell you 100 likes for a mere 50 Russian rubles. That's 89 cents. Welcome to the show, Louise.
Hey, Megan, how are you?
Good, thanks for coming on. So where did you first hear about the likes vending machine?
So I saw that a Russian correspondent posted it on Twitter, and I was kind of like, oh, this is really crazy. I've written before about people buying likes online, but I've never seen anywhere where you could do it in real life. So I kind of looked into it, tried to figure out what was going on. I had someone translate it. And then today I actually heard from a Russian publication, and I heard from the people who make this machine. And I found out that, it's real. There are about 20 of them all over Russia, and they're expanding to a handful of other European countries.
So I saw the picture. It looks like you can buy Instagram likes. Can you, what are those other icons for?
So on the right, you'll see VK, which is a popular Russian social media site. You can also buy fake likes for that site. As well as followers on both Instagram and VK. And then the site also gives you the machine also gives you the ability to print photos from your Instagram, which is, you know, handy if you want to pass those out to your friends. That costs the same, about 50 rubles for 2 photos. And what kind of users I saw tweeting about this, like Russian users, said that you need to select 2 photos. I'm not sure why. But yeah, you have to buy likes for 2 at once.
And what do the terms of service for these social media networks say about buying likes and followers?
So usually the way that they work is that all of the likes and all the followers come from bot accounts, which are kind of mass controlled. And they're drones. They don't actually represent real people. So every major social network prohibits you from doing this. It's considered a form of spam. It's kind of like a cat and mouse game with these companies. Back in 2015, Instagram banned hundreds of thousands of fake accounts that were participating in this kind of behavior. Twitter has an ongoing fake problem. Earlier this year, Facebook released a report detailing a lot of the fake bots that they have on their social network, especially operating in political groups. So yeah, they really hate this. And I'm surprised Instagram hasn't said something about it yet. I'm sure they will, or I'm sure they're going to do something about it. My inclination is that the company behind these machines probably don't understand how seriously Instagram takes this. But it's also pretty small scale. Like, it's only 100 followers or 100 likes. That's not, you know, that's chump change for Instagram.
Like, so, I mean, obviously, against the terms of service, and they don't like it very much. What can these companies do? I mean, I guess they could go after the company itself, or do they target the vending machines themselves? Or, like, where do you even begin with this sort of thing? I have to imagine. Like you said, it's a cat and mouse game. So how difficult is it?
So this is a really odd circumstance because it's not like a website. It's like a physical object that costs, you know, a lot of money to build and a lot of money to rent. So I'm curious to see about what Instagram's going to do here. It's my understanding in the past that they don't go after the companies themselves, but rather just the accounts. It's difficult to try and shut down, like, you know, dozens to hundreds of websites in hundreds of languages. It's easier to just mass ban, you know, accounts that are participating in this behavior, and they have algorithms in place that are looking for this kind of suspicious behavior. So if you tried to purchase 10,000 followers in a day, it's likely that you'd set something off inside Instagram that might get you banned.
And then once those accounts are killed, are destroyed, essentially, all of those likes that you thought you had suddenly just up and disappear, vanish into thin air, or do they stick around and you can remember them?
And I think it's kind of a complicated structure you're going through. Like two Russian journalists who tried this out, and they contacted me and shared their article. They said it didn't work, or at least didn't work immediately. And then they went back to the vending machine company and they're like, oh, sorry, like, we'll work on it. So it's not really a foolproof system because these accounts are getting banned often. And, you know, the janky, like, automation software that they're using to, like, carry this out, it's definitely not foolproof.
You said that this also might be just a way to get contacts to spam, that they're doing more than just giving you likes, but using your current real live followers and your email address to spam you.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. And, like, I don't want to, you know, accuse the company because it's not clear what would happen. I haven't tried the machine myself, but I have seen schemes in the past where it's like, you know, it's the classic phrase follow for follow. And I wouldn't be surprised if maybe they're trying to build a network of these accounts. So if you buy some likes, maybe in the future, you'll find yourself liking some pictures that you didn't mean to like. I think that's one mechanism that they might be using to try and carry this out. But yeah, and they have some, like, sketchy stuff in their pitch deck. It looks like it's Google translated, so I'm not exactly sure what they mean in the English version of their pitch deck. The company that makes the machines. But yeah, it appears like there's some sort of automated marketing that happens when you use this machine. I definitely would not recommend any Russian watching this that's trying to get some extra likes. This is maybe make a better post instead of trying to buy some likes.
I don't know. It kind of sounds like a value add to me. you get some extra spam on the back end. Everybody wins.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely interesting. But yeah, it was definitely a strange find. I love the idea. It's like super interesting to see this coming into the real world. And I just love how blatant it is. Mm-hmm. You know, we went to the mall and you bought some likes. I feel like traditionally it's been something that people, at least in the US, are a little bit more secretive about. I've heard of, like, ex-girlfriends, you know, buying a bunch of likes for their selfie to make their boyfriend jealous or something. But that's not something necessarily discussed in the open. And I like the idea of just doing it at the mall.
Yeah, you get your ears pierced. You go get some likes on your Instagram photo.
That's why you're getting your ears pierced. Yeah, that's why you're getting your ears pierced or buying the sunglasses at the mall so you get more likes. This is just right to the
social
source.
Media 101, people.
It is. I mean, you know, like you mentioned before, that their bots on Twitter and I'm assuming on Instagram are a huge problem because of, you know, the money that's changing hands on Instagram for sponsored posts. And on Twitter, I mean, we've heard horrible stories about these huge bots that might have, you know, influenced the election or have the ability to turn on certain people. So, you know, this is the lighter side of what is going on, which isn't always so light.
It just shows how easy it is to create this software, because I don't think that it was particularly difficult for, you know, the developers behind this machine to do this. The machine's not, you know, like, the most sophisticated, you know, piece of technology out there. As you can see, it's like a, you know, pretty low res LCD screen. I'm not, like, that impressed by it. So it shows how easy it is to do this. I really wish it wasn't so touchy for me to ask them how they did it. I wonder if they bought, you know, a botnet somewhere on the deep web, or like if they bought, you know, if they made 50,000 fake Instagram, you know, accounts or something to carry this out, or if it's a situation where you then involuntarily like a bunch of other posts later on. But yeah, it's super funny. It's, you know, a really fun story. And I'm glad that I like spotted it.
So when you're not covering Russian vending machines, what's your beat at Motherboard?
So I actually just started a couple days ago after I was a contractor for about 8 months last year. I was working as an editorial fellow. So I think I'm going to be covering kind of like this kind of stuff, like the weird internet, how our identities are changing online, a little bit of cybersecurity. I'm also really interested in just the major tech companies like Apple, Google, Uber, any weird stuff going on there. The weirder the better. And I love social media bots. I love like the automation of social media, especially because these companies really hate it. So it's fun to uncover kind of stuff.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, Louise Matsakis is, did I get that right? Matsakis?
Yeah, you got it.
is an assistant editor at Motherboard and L Matsakis on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Have a good night, you guys.
You too.
Have a good night. And we also had the opportunity to have a chat with C-Can Apcan from PBS NewsHour. We just got done kind of redoing our backyard, and I did consider using plaque as the foundation for all of our stuff in our backyard. I decided against it. But this interview is all about microorganisms and how you could potentially build concrete out of that. Here's our discussion on biocement.
We all know the three little pigs story. One lazy pig made his house of straw. Another lazy pig made his of sticks. And the third pig made his of sturdy, sturdy bricks. That little pig sure was industrious, but his brick house is doing no favors to our environment. Cement making creates 2 billion tons of CO2 emissions a year. That's more than those created by airplanes and ships combined. Today's guest has done more research into a more environmentally friendly kind of brick for little pigs and for us. C-Can Akpan from Science Scope on PBS NewsHour. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, so this idea comes from bacteria that you can find in caves where they make limestone. So to make regular cement, manufacturers heat limestone, which is also known as the chemical called calcium carbonate, to super high temperatures. You know, we're talking up to 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. The calcium carbonate breaks down into a powder that gets shipped to construction sites. You mix that powder with water, with rocks and sand, and the calcium carbonate comes back and it binds that rock and sand together to make concrete, and concrete, you know, holds up the world. That would all be fine and dandy, except the fossil fuels burned plus the chemical reaction of heating the limestone releases the carbon dioxide, as you said, to the tune of 2 billion tons per year. And despite what you may have heard, as far as we know, CO2 still causes global warming, so that's a problem. Biomason kind of cuts out the middle steps. You know, the bacteria replace the cement powder to make calcium carbonate that binds everything together without burning the fossil fuels or releasing the CO2.
So how did they get the idea to grow the cement with bacteria?
So as a child, Biomason's CEO, Ginger Krieg Dozier, she was fascinated with seashells and corals and how they're made. And so that tough stuff in seashells and corals is calcium carbonate. It's the same stuff in limestone. And a lot of marine organisms make it. So corals, seashells, sea stars, sand dollars, they all make it. They all naturally produce calcium carbonate, normally in shells or in their exoskeletons to protect themselves. So as a young architect, she was looking for a natural way to produce building materials, and she returned to this idea of calcium carbonate, or she returned to this idea of seashells, and that led her to trying to find a way to make calcium carbonate.
So I noticed in your video you have a picture of teeth. So I'm wondering, is this the same, like when you go to the dentist and it's like they have to, is that the same, like the way bacteria builds up on your teeth? Could I build something with that stuff?
Because that stuff is super, it can be super hard, yeah.
No, so calcium carbonate and calcium are in your teeth. Actually, the bacteria in your mouth work to break down the calcium in your teeth. So you don't want to use oral bacteria to build your house.
Okay.
That's too bad. We thought we could repurpose, or at least I'm speaking for myself. I thought I could repurpose some things, although it would take a lot of that to help my house.
You can still try. I mean, maybe you could create a competitor for Biomason.
Exactly. We're just going to need to bring everybody in for their teeth. So obviously this creates, there's a whole process that goes into creating this alternative to concrete. Is it, are there any differences in kind of how the longevity of the final product, how sturdy it is, how strong it is?
So right now they're doing some preliminary field testing. Actually, they have a courtyard out in San Francisco where you guys are based. And they do internal testing at the facility to try to meet the industry standards for cement in general. In terms of longevity, it should last just as long as regular cement. I mean, you're essentially creating calcium carbonate, which is in regular cement.
Got it.
In terms of timeline, it takes 3 to 4 days for the bacteria and the sand and all of it to solidify, which they said is sort of around the same timeline as regular cement, or like sort of producing regular cement or concrete. And then in terms of cost, it's kind of hard to compare because the starting materials are very different, but they're aiming for parity with regular concrete or regular cement.
Whoa. So the bacteria, once it becomes a brick in your house, the bacteria is dead. Like it couldn't, we're not talking about stuff you can't touch or you get sick, right?
Yeah, no, that's actually the kind of the cool part of this project. So it's a soil microbe of the variety Bacillus. It doesn't cause disease. And, you know, we're not talking about synthetic biology. It's not genetically modified. It's their process is closer to beer brewing. They found the right conditions to get the bacteria to spew out tons and tons of calcium carbonate. So you won't get sick from touching these bricks.
Okay. Good to know. So you said it's only one company, and they're in North Carolina, but it sounds like they're trying this out in San Francisco. They have a patio that they built in 2015. What are they sort of waiting for? Why haven't we seen this everywhere?
Well, so they're testing walls. I mean, they've basically been doing all the safety checks to make sure that the bricks last for as long as regular bricks. And this year they're going to be rolling out some bricks in structures. That's about it.
Well, you got to watch the video at PBS NewsHour. It's really interesting. A lot of detail on how bacteria can make a patio.
Well, we're about to make a patio at our house, so maybe we'll enlist the work of bacteria.
Well, you could try to just spit on the ground and see.
That's true.
Start with spitting on the ground and then see what happens.
Okay, all right.
I think that's going to work
so well.
That'll
be the next episode of the science.
No one wants to come over to my house if that's how we built our patio.
I don't. Thank you so much for joining us again. Sikan Apkpan is the digital science producer for the PBS NewsHour, and he is Mon Science on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. And now I know what to do with all that plaque. Too much information.
I never thought, I never found teeth talk so interesting as that interview.
Yeah, then I rushed home and brushed my teeth.
I feel like brushing my teeth again right now. So finally, this is our most recent interview. It was episode 3 of our new show, Tech News Weekly. We spoke to Maddie Van Hoof, the young researcher who discovered Crack, the Wi-Fi vulnerability.
Earlier this week, a security researcher posted a paper on something called Crack, spelled with a K, that threatens to basically destroy Wi-Fi privacy using WPA2 encryption. You can see it right here. It's affecting pretty much any device that supports Wi-Fi. And the internet, as you might expect, lost its love and mind. Joining us is Maddie Van Hoof, the researcher behind the discovery of Crack. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure to have you here. So, Maddie, let's start with a big picture. Crack stands for Key Reinstallation Attacks. Unpack that a little bit for those who aren't clear on how this actually affects WPA2 Wi-Fi security.
So, essentially, what happens when, say, your smartphone or laptop connects to a protected network, a so-called handshake is being executed, which negotiates a key, an encryption key that will be used to actually scramble and encrypt all the information that you are sending so that people nearby cannot receive it. Now, it's essential that that key will only be used once, because otherwise this encryption, the scrambling can be undone. And we found that here it goes wrong. We can actually force an Android phone or a smartphone or any smartphone or a laptop into using that key multiple times. In other words, into reinstalling this key. And then we can undo the encryption so we can recover the data that your device is sending.
Wow. And you're talking, I mean, we're so used to seeing, I'm an Android user. I'm so used to seeing this happened on Android and it being very specific to a certain classification of devices, manufacturers, whatever. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about, I mean, it's basically internet, you know, devices that connect to the internet, which is everything. I mean, does this also include historically unsecured devices like IoT devices in the home, smart home products, that sort of stuff?
So I would say that nearly all devices that implement Wi-Fi, that can connect to a protected Wi-Fi network, most of them are indeed affected by this attack. Wow. Now, interestingly, there are some operating systems, which is, for example, Windows, which does not completely follow the standard, and because of that, they are not affected by the biggest attack. However, I would assume that most Wi-Fi devices are indeed affected by it.
Mm-hmm. Now, on your site, crackattacks.com, again, spelled with a K, mm-hmm. You answer a lot of questions about this. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you've been seeing reported on this vulnerability as the week has progressed? Because there's been a lot of coverage on this. What were some of those biggest mm-hmm. misconceptions?
So that's a good question. I would say one of the misconceptions that I've seen a few times is that carrying out this attack would require the password of the network, and that's not the case. You do not need to have the password to perform this attack. Maybe one other misconception is a lot of people say you need to be really close to the network, and of course you need to be within range to be able to connect to the wireless network. However, there are special antennas which allow you to connect to a Wi-Fi network and carry out the attack, say, from a distance of up to 2 or maybe even 3 kilometers. Oh, so, wow. Yeah, you have to be nearby, but on the other hand, you also don't have to be that close.
Hmm. So we've heard that iOS, the newest version of iOS, has a fix, and Windows has a fix, and mm-hmm. we've heard all that. And what I've read is that means we're less vulnerable. Can you explain a little bit about what that means? I mean, are we still vulnerable even though it's been patched?
Well, I would say that as a home user, if you then update your Windows and your iOS devices, in that case, I would say you're secure. When you connect to a more enterprise, a more business network, for example, a university or a company that has a lot of access points, so a lot of places where the wireless signal is being broadcasted, then there could still be a bug in the equipment that they use. But for your home network, if you just update your Windows or your laptops and your smartphones, then you're already safe.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of times with discoveries like this, especially researchers discover a vulnerability, it's well before mm-hmm. anyone is actually doing anything with it. Are you aware of any tools mm-hmm. at this point that are kind of resulting in someone actively exploiting this vulnerability at this point? Have there been any signs that that's actually happening at this point?
So I'm not aware of any people or hackers that are currently using this tool to carry out attacks. It could be that someone made a tool but has not yet made it public. That's mm-hmm. one possibility. But I do think that making a program to carry out these attacks, it requires some technical expertise. So it could be, say, a few weeks before this happens. And then the question is also, will they release this tool or not? But of course, once such a program is available, then it becomes very easy for normal IT people to download such a tool and perform our attacks.
I'm interested in the process, your process. Like, how long have you been working on this paper? What gave you the idea? I mean, did you get a tip from someone, or was it just something that mm-hmm. you were sitting, around in the shower or something, and you just thought of it? How does it work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here we've been researching the security of Wi-Fi networks for quite a while already. I think more than 4 years. And while we were working on existing research, which was testing some other security aspects of a Wi-Fi network, I at one point basically just had an insight. I was reading some code. I was looking at one particular line, and I just had an insight, hey, what if something goes wrong here? What if this key is being installed? So it's a combination on the one hand, studying this wireless security for a long time already, and having the right insight at the right moment. And that happened, I think, around half a year ago. And then we started to investigate it in detail. We wrote a paper. Then in the summer, we contacted the companies. And here we are today.
And is it competitive? Were there other people trying to get there before you? Is it like what we, you know, like a journalist trying to chase a story? Mm-hmm. Or is it really just you guys?
Well, I would assume that it was mainly us because this technology that protects your Wi-Fi network, so the one we attacked, it has already existed for more than 14 years. And during that time, no one has found an attack like us against it. So a lot of people assumed that it was secure. I mean, there are even mathematical proofs which try to formally prove that it is correct. So it's a very surprising finding. And with that in mind, I don't think there was... There were other researchers that were really looking at this.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also posted a script on GitHub that basically tests mm-hmm. access points for the crack mm-hmm. attack. If someone, you know, downloads that and finds that their access point is vulnerable, I mean, what is the recommendation there? Obviously, updating the firmware, as mm-hmm. as you say, updating it when there's a security update, but given that there are a lot of devices that there won't be a security update, Android, and you know a lot of other devices that just aren't mm-hmm. typically updated with the same frequency as others that are. I mean, what is the recommendation there? Is it that you just don't use them anymore, or like where do you go with that?
So that's a good question. So if you find that your access point is vulnerable, or in the future, I will also release the scripts to test if your Android or your smartphone is vulnerable. In that case, you can try to put some pressure on the company if a lot of people start to complain. But of course, it will be likely that certain devices will not get updated. And in fact, I'm quite sure of that. That's indeed a problem. So what ordinary users can do is first and for all, when they visit the website, make sure that HTTPS is being used, then all your data is still properly protected. And we are also going to look into other ways to try to lower the impact of attacks. So we are looking into things where if devices don't get updates, it's still possible to protect them somehow, but that's something we are still investigating.
Yeah, and that's the biggest frustration for me. I mean, I don't even know how how much faith I have that a lot of these devices are going to get updated. Like Google mm-hmm. has an update scheduled for, I think, their November security update. But as we know uh-huh. with Android, that's the first mm-hmm. step. And from there, it falls in the hands of the OEMs to, you know, to mm-hmm. actually take it to the finish line and bring it to their devices. But that doesn't help a device that's 3 or 4 years old that doesn't get updates anymore. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of left out in the cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's quite a known problem with Android, that if mm-hmm. they have a security vulnerability, that a lot of people do not get updates. And also with other Wi-Fi devices, it's true. I don't expect that a lot of them will be updated. I think the latest ones, yeah, they will get an update. Yeah. But indeed, a lot of people will be left in the cold, and that's very unfortunate. Also, especially with the Android case, attackers could abuse this they could combine this with other weaknesses, with other vulnerabilities, which would really make the impact quite bad.
Yeah, I suppose we'll be following this. Matty Vanhoef, first of all, thank you for taking the time to mm-hmm. talk with us. And secondly, going backwards, thank you for discovering this because everybody needs to know about it. And it's super important. So it's really great work that you're doing. Where can people follow everything, all the research and everything that you're doing online?
So I have a Twitter account online. You can follow that. It's my last name, Vanhoef, M, with the M at the end. I also have a blog, but that doesn't get updated that frequently. So the best thing is to follow my Twitter feed.
Right on. Thank you again, Maddie, and best of luck with your research. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Take
care.
Thank you. Wasn't that great?
We are, of course, recording this early, so we can pretend like our holidays were perfect. All of our kids got exactly what they wanted.
They did.
We did not drink too much eggnog. We did not eat too many Christmas-shaped cinnamon rolls.
Do you drink eggnog? Do you like
eggnog at all? I don't. No.
I always trick myself into thinking that I like eggnog, and I always end up getting one of the smaller cartons, and I drink one, and then it makes my stomach hurt, and the rest of it just rots in the fridge. Too much information. Sorry.
I know. Well, I will also share, since you were oversharing.
Yes.
I don't like any drinks with egg in them, like no alcoholic drinks with an egg in them. I want that to end. I don't want to see that anymore. Maybe 2018 is the year where all drinks in bars with eggs in them, off the table.
Not true. Sometimes those drinks are really good. They're nice and frothy and stuff.
Gross.
It's just when they put like a raw egg on top and they're like, here you go. I don't know if that ever happens. There's got to be a drink where they do that.
I think there is. I don't know. Ask Alex. He knows about that. He probably
Yeah, he laughed, so he knows. Tech News Weekly normally records every Thursday live at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll begin recording at that time on Thursday next week. So you want to tune in then, and you can go to, you can send us an email if you want to be part. Maybe you've got something that you want us to read on next week's show, tnw@twit.tv.
Subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. And even better, come visit us. See a live show. All you have to do is email tickets@twit.tv. That's tickets@twit.tv. You have to send the email. Don't just show up. We're not going to let you in unless you email us. And if you're not coming, tell me why by tweeting at me. I'm at Megan Maroney.
Megan really wants to know why you're not coming to watch us live. So do I. Tweet CC me as well. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to everyone that works throughout the year to help us on this show. Alex, Jammer B, Burke, Josh, of course. Kevin has helped in the past. Pretty much everybody here helps. Colleen, yes. Occasionally she paces back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Padre.
Sometimes he comes in here and bugs us. Leo and Lisa, they kind of run the shop. Everyone, let's just say everyone, thank you. And thanks to you for watching week in and week out. We hope you have a fantastic new year, and we'll see you next week. How about the last high five of the year on Tech News Weekly?
I got it.
Here we go.